Please be advised this podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature. It's not appropriate for children.
In the last 12 months, 368 youths were given a caution for assault. Almost 600 were handed out for property damage, while more than 100 caught with weapons or explosive offences were also let off with a warning. Yet many of the offenders escaping with a caution have already committed up to 10 crimes.
We have around about 570 odd young offenders who are in this category of regular offending, high risk offending and offending that's causing huge trauma.
When I hear about youth offenders, I immediately imagine traumatised children. I can't imagine that a young person could become a violent offender without having lived through violence themselves. And I'm inclined to feel pity for them, to feel sorry that something so terrible happened to them, that it changed them in this way in their formative years. I have the privilege of being able to think about youth offenders that way because I've never encountered any. I've never, touch wood, never been offended by a youth offender. But today we'll hear from a woman whose family has indeed been changed forever in the worst possible way by two young offenders.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb.
Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
Janine Greening is a founder of the Forget Me Not Foundation, a group dedicated to supporting and advocating for the families of victims of crime. The group includes the relatives of some of Australia's highest profile victims, including Jane Thurgood Dove and Messina Halvargis. Janine lost her elderly mother in the year 2000 in a horrifying home invasion that catapulted Janine to the forefront of what some people are calling Australia's juvenile crime epidemic.
Janine took a break from her busy life as a mother, a grandmother and an advocate for victims of crime to talk to us for our podcast.
I would describe you as an absolutely tireless warrior almost for victims' rights, victims of violent crimes and homicides. I want you to tell us about what happened to your mum, because that you were always into helping people before that, but what happened to your mum was a crime that was really shocking, but also it changed you, didn't it?
My mother was 73 years of age. She was a psychologist with victims of crime. She was a carer for my disabled brother, and she was raped in ways I cannot even tell you, with instruments, so forth. It was horrific, like a lot of crime is horrific. She was bashed, she was stood on, her ribs were broken, her nose was broken, she was bashed in the head. She hemorrhaged from other parts of the body, still was alive. There was still that fight in her from all the reports I've read. And then she was, they tried to smother her, these two youth offenders. Then they strangled her after many hours of torture in front of my disabled brother, who was cut on the face. But I often think her last thing would have been thinking about him. That would have been her last thoughts. That's what I think. But she'd rang me when the killers came to the house, and I wasn't home. So
did they break into the house? What happened, Janine? Like, what was, where was your mum living in? And tell us as well about your brother.
My mother was living in Fortescue Avenue, Seaford, where I lived. We both lived in the same street. I spoke to her three times a day. It was actually a very, very, very close relationship, but it was more so, she wasn't like my mother. She was like my best friend. It was like someone, it's like she was the same age. She'd ring me up and say, what am I going to eat for tea? And I'd think, what? Or what am I going to have for lunch? What are you having? Or what are you going to watch on TV? It was just, minor things, and there'd be big discussions, and I can't really describe it, but she was just this amazing person that seemed to give other people the confidence to do things. But with my brother, he lived in the same street because he lived with my mother, and I'd see him, he'd come down to my house every morning about 2 o'clock in the morning and knock on my door and come to visit me. So that would be very interesting. He'd come in and expect his cup of tea and all the other stuff, and I'd have to send him back home in a taxi, so forth. So that would, I had years of that, and it was quite humorous. And he used to take him off to self off to Safeway. I don't really know what to say. It's hard to describe.
Well, no, I think you're describing it perfectly. It was a really simple life with a close-knit family, all close together and helping each other in every way.
It was, but it was even more than that. I don't think I've ever in my whole life met anyone like my mother.
She came to education later in life, didn't she, Janine? She was quite interesting.
Yeah, she was 49 years of age. She had decided to be a psychologist after my father died. And in those days she didn't have the pension you have. So she decided to go and do year 12. So she went off to school, actual school of 16, 17-year-olds, and did her year 12 again. And then she was at Monash, and she lived at Monash. She was a student there in a time when Peter Costello was there and all these interesting people. Then she got married at Melbourne University to my stepfather, of course, who I'd known since I was a child. And he died at Target, of all places. He dropped dead at Target. So, and then she'd had cancer. She was a survivor of cancer. And I'm probably waffling on here, but
no, I think
I don't
it's
know
really,
which way to go.
I think it's really right. valuable. I mean, we like to hear as much about the victim as we can so that we and our listeners can really think about this person as a person and, you know, living a normal life like we're all living, where we all expect to be left alone in our lives and to be able to live them out safely.
I will tell you this, though. Being a psychologist, she wasn't like any other psychologist I've ever met. When she had cancer, people would come to see her, and they would sit at the end of her bed. And here she was, you know, like she was going from her chemo and everything, and she'd be laying in her bed and people would be talking to her, but she wouldn't charge them. And she used to say to them, no, I won't charge you. I'm not here to make money. And a place was falling apart because my brother, different medication that was given to him. And as you know, my brother had been experimented on. He'd been sexually abused in the system, in mental health,
system.
In mental health, disability. Mm-hmm. He'd been assaulted. But as a child, he had what they call autistic spectrum, and back in the 60s people didn't know anything about it, and my mother was onto this, and she had a big, like, she went and got the St Kilda Town Hall, because we're all from St Kilda, and she got these people interested in autism, which I'd never heard of in the 60s, but she was way ahead of her time. And she was trying to educate people about it, but she couldn't prove he had it, but she suspected it. And back then he wasn't well, and he's at St Vincent Hospital, and what they did was they thought he had sort of quirky behaviour, sort of just a bit unusual, and it was slight autism, and he was on that, you know, that spectrum. It was very, like, you wouldn't notice it unless you're really with him a lot, and very clever boy. And when he was in St Vincent's, what they did was they gave him insulin treatment, which is banned today, then they gave him shock therapy, shock treatment, and he was only 12 years of age, and he was in with all these older people in the adult part. So the person that came out of that hospital after 6 months, I didn't recognise that person, all the medications, all the things, and over the years. And so, you know, you didn't know what you were going to come home to.
So you're saying that he was more severely disabled
by those treatments.
Yes, he was. But okay. What they did to him,
yep.
It was evil, like they did to many other people, using shock treatment when people weren't mentally ill in the beginning and experimenting on them. And that's what they did. And my mother, it wasn't in her hands. She had no rights. So they could do all these things to him along the way. So
as a consequence, as an adult, he still lived with your mum?
He did. He lived with my mum because he really couldn't live by himself, but he could go out. He had a life. But that day that she was murdered and raped, his life was taken.
I'm really so sorry to take you back to that night that everything changed. Who were these people? How did they get into her home?
One was a 15-year-old boy and one was a 16-year-old boy. The 15-year-old boy I knew from the age of 8.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that you knew the perpetrators.
One of them.
One of them.
The 8-year-old used to come to my house every weekend. So as you would, an 8-year-old, we liked him. He was cheeky and we liked him.
How did you meet him?
My children, youngest children, went to school with him.
Mm.
And he had this way about him. He'd have a cheeky smile and that, and I suppose we felt sorry for him, and he'd come on a Friday night and go home Sunday, except for Christmas and Easter, but he'd be there for years at our place. So I'd take him out to different places and that, because I used to have a lot to do with graffiti kids and other kids and very involved. So I suppose we believed in helping other people, and you know, I'm not saying we were perfect. We weren't. We had our stuff, but you know, we just felt you know, he liked coming, and we liked him. And along the way, as time went on, he sort of started to change, or maybe we didn't really know who he was. You know, things would go missing, and I had so many kids coming in and out, and it was a shock to find it was him. It was a shock because I was hoping it wasn't him. I thought it was some other people involved with him. But
so he knew your mother?
Oh, yes, he knew my mother, yeah. And he'd gone prior to that with the other boy trying to do jobs at her place. And my mother rang me and told me he brought the other boy there. And I said, I've heard of him. Do not leave him in your house. And, yeah.
And this one day they both arrived at your mum's house?
Not one day. They came the day before, Michelle. They had broken into my mother's house the day before. I don't know if you know
this. No,
okay, they broke in the day before and they had she was asleep and they'd taken her bag, ransacked her house. And they had thrown her bag into the park nearby. We're talking about Seaford Road, the park there. And my mother told me, you know, she rang the police. And the police, of course, which really I am angry about. I'm really angry with the way the whole case was investigated. She couldn't go get down to them because she couldn't stand for long and not taking my brother in tow with her. So they said to her, oh, well, this was a Saturday. They said, oh, we can't get to you. We'll come on Monday, you know. So they did come on the Monday, didn't they, because they came back the next day to murder her.
Oh, my God.
Monday was too late for her.
That's right.
I mean, I would never have guessed. Would you have ever thought? Obviously, you never thought those boys would come back and kill her.
I actually said to her, I said, they will come back.
Oh, God.
I felt it. I felt it. I said, they will. I don't know why I said, but I just felt it. And my mother sort of, and the only reason I said that is because we'd had stalking. I'd had stalking. She'd had stalking. And I'd say to her, call the police. She goes, no, I'm not going to call the police. She said, look at you. You call the police and what do they do? And don't get me wrong, I'm not against police. There's a lot of good police. It's just in this incident, I wasn't happy with the whole, and I'm still not happy with it. So she didn't call the police. She'd have me on the phone and there'd be noise in her backyard and stuff going on. And, you know, it just sort of
how terrifying.
Well, it's just sort of like when she said to me about the bag and everything, and a man found a bag and came back with it, the money had been taken, but all her phones, like she'd a few phones in different rooms, and they'd all been pulled out of the wall. And there were other things. I can't explain it, but I just, when she said that, I said they could come back, but I didn't expect it to be the next day. And that's what I didn't expect. I thought, yeah, they could come back. But I just got shocked that it was the next day. And I thought, why didn't the police just go down to it? Why didn't they take it seriously? Because then it could have been prevented.
And what happened was just an escalation beyond anyone's worst nightmare, what they came back and did.
I don't think anyone would even really, if you've read the reports, I can say to you, but it's very brief. But it's like we didn't know that that's what they did, but exactly what they did till 4 years later when we were in the High Court in Canberra. We didn't know the thing of the sexual assaults done on her. Not one, not two, not. If I was to tell you exactly, which I'm not, you'd be sick to your stomach. And that's why these two boys were, it was
very dangerous.
Well, it's not even dangerous, really evil, because one of these boys had been in the juvenile centre. And as you know, they rang me from the youth detention centre with the dirty sexual songs from the Parkville. We're talking about Parkville.
These two offenders, after they had been arrested and sent to the juvenile detention centre, phoned you at home and taunted you.
Yes, and twice, two phone calls. One was a death threat to a family member, and the second one, and it was on my answering machine, though, thank goodness. And the second one was this dirty sexual song, the laughter in it. And this is a 15-year-old.
You can hear him laughing. It was the words to I'm a Little Teapot,
yes,
wasn't it?
And you can imagine, I'm a little teapot, here is, and then you go the words, and then he doesn't have the words there, but you know what the words are, what he's saying to some of, and he's laughing. And then with that, while they were in the juvenile centre, and here we are today, we're back 16 years and a couple of months, and you think about that, nothing's changed in that time. And we're talking about Parkville detention, whatever you call it.
Youth detention, the scene of some recent riots.
Yes. And then you're talking about the other one too, where the other one was in Malmesbury. So if you look at that, you've got the same two juvenile centres we're talking about today, and that was the same back then. Now, when they were in the Melbourne Juvenile Detention Centre, not only did they call me, but at that time they were threatening staff. They would carry on about it because they didn't get enough swims like they are today. Exactly the same behaviour. Yeah, like in the pool or the time or so forth. And there'd be so many threats to staff. One broke his parole twice when he got out. First time he broke it, they wouldn't, of course, they're not going to tell you why, but I was told, but I can't say. But he was put back in prison for 2 years then for whatever he committed.
Would have been fairly serious.
Yes, for 2 years he got put into prison. The other one we would often see break his parole, but when we go to ring up to tell him, there was no one to ring at that time.
What do you mean you saw him break his parole?
Well, in other words, he wasn't supposed to be in Frankston area, and he'd be standing in front of us breaking, like he'd be out. And that's part of the condition. So he's breaking his parole.
Were they arrested soon after your mum's?
Yes, so arrested within that week. My mother, as I told you, rang me on that night and told me they were there.
She left that on your answering machine?
Yes, she did. Okay. One of them, his DNA wasn't found on anything, but there was like gloves near in my mother's room. They were for the workers that came in to help with my brother, and they were the plastic gloves you wear. Well, at the front door of my mother's house, which was brought up to the police, why didn't you take those gloves that were on the front porch? They'd been there. I was in hospital for 2 weeks, and for having a heart attack from the whole thing. So when I came back to the door, those gloves were still there. And here they are talking about them, but the police didn't take those gloves, which they think, obviously, one of them.
Yeah, was wearing, was and so wearing it should them. Have had his DNA inside
yes,
them.
Yes, it would have had if they were taken. It was still on the front door. So the other one's DNA was in mum's nails, the 15-year-old.
Wow.
But he kept blaming the other one. The other one kept saying he wasn't there, but then there was proof from taxi drivers of his. A lot of people came to me after my mother's murder and told me a whole lot of information. One person who was a very in a prominent position that told me his neighbour lived next door to my mother and they could hear her screaming and the two killers had come to her house, right? And then I was told by another person who was looking for me for about 3 years to tell me that he saw them down by the Cannock Creek, and obviously that's, and they were putting stuff there, so it must have been evidence. So I'm only assuming that part. I was just told all these, and a whole lot of other stuff too, that they had a hit list and there were other people on it. There's a whole lot of different stuff I was told after. But
Were they using drugs? Is there, you know, is there anything?
No, no.
Really?
No, they weren't. One of them, okay, the 16-year-old, he, what he used to do was when he was at work, now, people obviously knew. Let's face it, if you had a co-worker that was standing here in front of you every day at your work saying, oh, look at that girl, you know, I'd love to hit her on the head and rape her.
Wow.
Now, if you've got a guy talking like that about young girls, doesn't that give a bells ring with you? Doesn't it tell you something? If you're a guy, doesn't that tell you something? What's that saying to you?
This is this one of your perpetrators
yes,
was saying these that. Things about.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
So if that 16-year-old is saying that, then why were people accepting that? Why were the women around him, the men around him? This is what I'm saying to you. I'm saying, what is wrong with our society that they think that is acceptable? The guy in charge kept saying to him, don't talk like that. And when he came to work one day, he said, I bashed a woman or I robbed a woman and I bashed a woman. That was my mum he was talking about. And the guy said, don't tell, you know, I don't want to know. This is the problem. This is, and we've still got this problem now
yeah.
with youth offenders. We've still got this problem now. You know, and you look at back at 2015, we had over 20,000 youth offenders in Victoria and 400 of them were sex offenders, as I've said. How many of those are going to be adult sex offenders? But here he is. People allowed him to get to where he is. And when he was in the detention centre, he tried to attack another girl. Now, she was on...
some of
placement.
This was reported, wasn't
yes,
it,
yeah.
in the Herald Sun
yes,
at the time,
some of
wasn't
it,
it,
but they yeah. didn't couldn't tell the whole story, and I know why, but it was on work placement, and here he is.
So he, for one, was this just the reason I ask if these kids were on drugs is because the attack that they perpetrated against your mother is so bizarre to me. I just can't get my head around it. Was it a thrill killing for them?
It was a thrill killing. It's one of them said that evidently he hates his own grandmother
right.
and some other rubbish. And
okay.
let's face it, what it is, it's about power. We yep. know that with sexual abuse and all these rapes and everything, it's nothing about sex. It's we know that it's about power. We know that it's about having control.
So we know by this stage we have irrefutable proof that we've got at least one very serious sex offender here.
Yes.
And the other boy, I don't know if he's a follower or if he's just as damaged. What sort of penalty did they receive when they were convicted of the rape and murder of your mum?
Well, first they got 4 years with 2 years.
So they got a 4-year sentence with 2-year non-parole for murdering and raping a woman.
Well, the thing is, they
what were they charged with?
They weren't
exactly?
charged with murder, and they weren't charged for sexual assault.
What were they charged with then?
They were charged for I've forgotten the word. It was like aiding and abetting and
why
manslaughter. In the end, it was manslaughter. You only heard murder once, and we got a plea bargain. We didn't ask for it. We were told we had no choice and we had to accept it because the thing is, and I'm going to be honest, I don't mind saying this, the police botched the whole case. And why I say they botched it, and this is where I say they botched it, and no, it wasn't against the police, but they botched it because, like, when you can imagine, if you come back to your mother's home, the gloves are on the in front of the door, all her jewellery is out on the lawn. Now, why wouldn't you pick up that jewellery?
Yeah.
That's the jewellery they dropped when they came out. I found a present I'd given her at the front door, a brooch. Her car later on was set alight by somebody and family members stalked me. I had friends of theirs stalked me for 8 years. I had to move 3 times. I lost my house there, but that's not the point. I lost my mother. We've got. It's like someone wrote recently, Justin Quill, he wrote an article in the Herald Sun just recently, and what he said is, Janine can go down the street and those killers can walk past. I won't know who they are, but they'll know who I am. Why is that? And what is it that a suppression order that for their safety, what about public safety? What about the communities?
Can you describe suppression orders to us, please? I'd never heard of them until I came to hear you speak one day about them.
All right. The suppression orders, if I was to say their names, I would get 9 years jail.
If you were to say the names of the boys, men now, who murdered your mum,
yes,
you'd go to jail.
I'd get 9 years.
Why do suppression orders get put in place? So they were juvenile offenders, but why do people put suppression orders in place or judges?
Okay, so there's different examples with the suppression orders, right? They say it's for the children's sake. Which children? Not for my children. My children were teenagers, the same age, my youngest ones. And it wasn't for my oldest grandson who knew one of them and really liked him. It's really affected him to this day. He's 24 now. So what children are we talking about? We're talking about these a 15, 16-year-old boy. So the thing is, I believe in rehabilitation, but if you haven't, you're not sorry for what you have done. If you have no empathy for and not sorry, how can you be rehabilitated?
I can almost understand this, the idea that a person commits a crime as a child. Ideally, that person is rehabilitated. And so as an adult, I shouldn't be able to Google their name and find out this thing that happened before. But this extends into legal proceedings, doesn't it? If that person reoffends as an adult, they can't even...
Well, he did reoffend. He was in one, that 16-year-old was in the Geelong court, and I went with a Herald Sun reporter. It was I've forgotten what it was over something trivial, but the point was he broke his parole a second time, so he didn't go back to jail this time because obviously the first time was a more serious crime. So he had, and he was living with a policeman who was vouching for him, which shocked us all in the Geelong court. So he, they couldn't name him, and at that time one of his relatives went around naming him, we were told, but then that was, we don't know what happened there, but they went around naming him in public with a big poster.
Wow.
And he, just being in the room with him and seeing him walk past me, He's sort of like you look at him, but it's like you're looking through him.
Mm.
You understand what I mean in the way I say that. You know when you can look into someone's eyes or look in their face and you actually see a soul or you see something, but it was like nothing.
Did he look at you? Did he know you were there?
Oh, yeah. He knows who I am.
What sort of reaction did he give you, or if any?
None. Like he's, it wouldn't affect him. Nothing would affect him. Like you can feel it. Even from Mako, they went, you know, actually one of them said, do you know what you did? And you know, to him. It's like, it's a joke to him. It's like the one time when he was in the Herald Sun again, he's they're talking about his Facebook page. He's calling sex offenders evil and he wants to do this to him. And I said, well, what does he think he is? That's what he is. That's what you are.
So, but the younger of the two was the one that you had known since he was eight.
Yes.
The one that you took under your wing as a family.
Yes.
Whatever became of him?
I don't know. And to be honest with you, I don't care.
I don't blame you for that.
I don't care what happens to him.
No. I guess I wonder, I hope that at some point he's realised and, sorry.
I can honestly say if I thought he was sorry, he wouldn't have done all the things after.
Yeah.
He wouldn't have, you don't go and ring someone up. You see, there was something wrong, and I've read the reports. There's something not right. And looking back, it's sort of like the comprehension, or a lot of the times he'd make out he was afraid of the other one, but he wasn't. And when you hear that laughing, you know something, it isn't right. For someone, you see, if someone says sorry to me, if they'd said sorry from the beginning, then we could have moved on. Doesn't mean you get over it. You don't, but you can move on because you know that then they're sorry, then they've got a chance. But if they're not sorry and they're doing all those behaviours, there's no hope.
You are acting very much like your mum, really, because you are a very generous person. You've dedicated your life to helping others and you continue to do that. And the Forget Me Not Foundation is another great example of the work you do for others. And that is a support group for Victorian homicide victims' families. I went along to a forum that you put together and met the parents of victims, the husbands, the sisters of victims. It was an extraordinary thing to witness. The strength in the group is amazing. I remember watching a young woman get up to speak about her murdered sister. And she started to break down and cry. And George Helvargas, whose daughter Messina was murdered, George didn't know this woman. And he just got up and he walked up and he just stood next to her and he didn't touch her. He just stood right next to her and she rallied and she finished saying what she wanted to say. And it was amazing to watch. I just realised in that moment the strength you draw from each other.
It's we're like a family. I've been in many groups and I'm on other groups and I've never, from day one, because we started up the National Victims of Crime Awareness Week, then from that came the Forget Me Not Foundation. And someone said to me, it was a news from someone from Current Affairs or something, I said, why did you call it the Forget Me Not? I said, well, I did want to call it Marie Green Sedan, because it becomes about one person. And I'm not having a go at anyone else, but that's what I believe. Mm. And the forget-me-not is about remembering. Well, to be honest, I'll be honest with you girls, it's not really what I envisioned myself to be doing. I've been volunteering since I was 8 years of age, and I remember the first time I did voluntary work, I was with the Red Cross, and I always believed in giving back what you take from this world. And I think my mother always used to say, there's more takers than there are givers. I'm saying it back to the front. But that's what she'd say. And I believe that. I think there's so many people taking and there's not enough giving. And I think that's what's sad. And here we are. We're talking about today about juvenile offenders. We're talking about suppression orders. And why is it that I've had to fight as long as I have and other people like me for suppression orders to go, and we can't do that. Nobody is listening. And actually in the media, they don't talk about it. It's like we're silenced. That's what it's like.
I promise you we'll chase it up. We'll do whatever we can and we'll try and find out some answers to those questions. Also on our Facebook page, we'll have links to everything that you are doing and that you are up to, so that people, other victims of crime, can get access to the resources that you have worked tirelessly to put together. Thank you so much, not just for talking to us today, but for everything you've done for everyone.
Well, thank you very much, girls, for having me here. And thank you for being interested in victims of crime.
Well, that's about as harrowing a tale from about as lovely a lady as you'll ever hear in your lifetime, I think, and I hope. Janine Greening there talking about the terrible murder of her mother at the hands of a 15-year-old and a 16-year-old.
And within that conversation, she mentioned a couple of youth detention centres in Victoria, Parkville and Malmesbury. Both of these centres have been in the news a lot lately because of riots, like extremely violent riots in which wings of the buildings have been left completely uninhabitable, needing to be rebuilt. It really all just comes together to paint a terrifying picture. But Tiffany overall is a person who doesn't need a picture painted. She's been there. She is a youth worker. She's an advocacy and human rights officer and convener of Smart Justice for Young People. She works at a place called Youth Law, and they help with legal advice and legal services for young offenders. So she is perfectly placed to give us another perspective on the youth crime epidemic, if it really exists, and also a look into these youth detention centres to see if any good is coming out of them at all.
My condolences go to Janine and her family and all victims being affected by such, you know, horrific and violent crimes. And there is no excuse for that sort of behaviour, that these young people have to be made accountable within a system. And I would suppose I would say at that very horrific end of the system, all that we need to keep in mind is obviously with those young people, as much as we would want revenge, as much as we would want punitive outcomes for those young people involved, at the end of the day, potentially they are going to be members of our community again, you know, because if they go in having spent time in the system, coming out more damaged, more hardened, more violent, that is in no way going to contribute to longer term community safety. I suppose that's what we just need to keep reminding the community, that this is all about community safety. This is all about stopping their being victims. And we just have to really be careful about how we go about that, and just to come in and take a really tough law and order approach isn't necessarily going to be the long-term solution in this space. We do acknowledge at the moment there is a spike and sort of a very serious issue with violent youth offending in terms of the carjackings, the home burglaries, etc. that we're hearing about. We're looking at somewhere between 200-300 young people committing multiple offences. And these, obviously, this is a really difficult issue for police community to tackle. But I really honestly believe we know so much about who these young people are. We know the communities they're from. We can really go in and provide very, very, intensive work to try and address this issue at its core, rather than at what we're worried about, I suppose, as advocates in the system, is that it's in this current pressurised environment where people are feeling scared and the government's feeling pressured to make decisions in response to that, is that we're going to unravel parts of the youth justice system that are really, really, really important that we maintain and that we strengthen.
What are you seeing? What is the trend? Why are they're particularly violent offences where the young people, go on the police chases and don't seem to care that, the cops are chasing them?
Yeah, look, I mean, obviously there is a diversity of young people involved. I mean, from what we know from police and from community workers on the ground, it's young people from a mix of ethnicities. I mean, yes, apparently African and Pacific are fairly highly represented, but they're also Caucasian young people. What we're hearing, again, from what we know through Victoria Police about these young people, is that a lot of these young people are feeling totally disengaged from community. They, whether that's not being engaged at school, whether that's not feeling they've got any hope in terms of accessing normal employment opportunities. Some are having, obviously, issues with dysfunctional families, breakdowns of families, but I suppose that's, those sorts of issues have been around in our society for a long time, and so it is really difficult to get to the heart of why these kids are behaving the way they are. But as troubling and as concerning as this feels, it feels like there have been other points in time, you know, that there have been spikes in different trends in offending. And obviously part of it's the quick cash, you know, the thrill of quick cash, taking control, as brief as it might be. Obviously drugs could be involved. There's really is a whole range of factors.
What do you think about the idea that the sort of lack of deterrent is a problem, that even the juvenile detention centres aren't a big deterrent, that the kids in there are treated too well, they have too many perks, that they riot over pizza, and that, you know, that we're too soft on juvenile offenders? What do you think about that?
Look, I think that's something that you do hear expressed in the community. I feel like if community members could maybe walk a day or two in the shoes of a young person that is maybe either put into youth detention, either unsentenced, the matter hasn't come before the courts yet, which is the bulk of the kids in youth detention, sadly, or if they have been sentenced for a serious matter and they are in detention, it's not a breeze, it's not a summer camp. These young people really are held accountable. It's you know, I've visited places like Parkville, for example, and I can assure you, and I was a bit shocked actually, because there is supposed to be a bit of a, you know, significant distinction between the adult prison system and the kids prison system. But I also need to, you know, remind the community that historically the focus has always been on the ways and means of getting to the heart of what's behind these offending for these kids, trying to turn their lives around, trying to rehabilitate them for the reasons I mentioned before, that ultimately, if we don't do it then, and that's all the evidence says, we've got the best opportunity to do that when these people are young than when they get hardened and they find themselves in the adult system. If we don't get in then, we're sending them on a trajectory through the adult system, and which means ultimately we just get much more hardened, damaged, violent people coming out the other end, and that's not, I don't think that's what anyone wants. We all ultimately want the same thing. We want the community to feel safe. We want less victims of crime. When a kid gets to that point of offending behaviour, if they find themselves in detention, that's a window of opportunity, arguably, to really spend some intensive time with these kids to find out what's maybe the trauma behind their offending. What's maybe the drug and alcohol substance abuse behind their offending? Like, do a really thorough assessment. Find out, is there mental health issues? Is there cognitive impairment? What's really going on? Do that thorough assessment and start then. Really get them back on track and have some of those supports flowing back into the community when they're released. You know, we hear good things about Parkville College, for example, the education centre, Parkville. But
can I just interrupt you to say that's fascinating, because I don't hear those things. You know, unfortunately, we in the community, when we hear Parkville, we hear riots, smashing down half the facility has to be rebuilt. There are great things coming out of this centre.
Over the years, there definitely have been some really excellent work. And I suppose prior to what sort of flared up in the last 4 months or so, Parkville College was a little bit of a shining beacon in terms of, for some of the kids in there, this is the first time they were engaging in education for years and years. There's such opportunities to run really good trauma-informed therapeutic programs at these places. And you hear, sadly at the moment in this environment, you're hearing people are suggesting therapeutic treatment is the soft option. That's too soft. That's going soft. And we actually haven't even done the therapeutic option very well in Victoria. Now's the time to actually be trying it, to really try and turn these young people's lives around. That's what it should be about. You look at models in other countries, they're completely coming through a completely different frame. They've got these amazing centres in Spain, and they call them re-education centres. They're not kid prisons. They're not, you know, youth justice detention centres. They're re-education. They're acknowledging these kids need leg up, they need someone on their side, they need some mentors, they need some intensive psychological support. Like, they have daily psychological support, because if we don't invest in these kids at that time, potentially we lose them.
There seems to need to be a bit of parental responsibility. I mean, obviously DHS needs to kick in when needed, but what about the parents? Yeah. Can't they get on top of it?
Look, I think it's probably just really harks back to one of the tragedies of our society, You know, there's been a huge focus of recent times about the level of child abuse and neglect in a whole lot of settings, and that's including in the home setting. We know that at any point in time, kids that are either engaging in the criminal justice system or are in youth detention, probably around at least 40% of those kids are in the child protection system.
That's pretty big, isn't it? Big statistic.
It's massive. It's massive. So I suppose my point there is that until we can break that cycle, until we can actually really get in there and, you know, build resilient, supportive families that are looking after their kids as we'd hope they would, we're not going to break this cycle. It's a really vicious cycle.
If you like reading about Australian true crime, be sure to pick up our very own Emily Webb's books, Murder in Suburbia, Suburban Nightmare and Angels of Death. Just hit the Shop Now button on our Facebook page.
Thank you for downloading our Australian True Crime podcast. If you have an Australian true crime story of your own you'd like to share with us, let us know on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
We'd also love it if you'd give us a nice review and 5 stars on iTunes. Thank you to Sherry Laurie, Michael Davron, Kieran Simpson and Alex Loran for their help in pulling this project together. We'll be back with more Australian true crime next week. Until then, stay safe and don't kill anyone.